welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vow, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Jack. I love it that you can get the name Center for Western Studies in three times in the introduction every time. I'm always impressed.
That you're earn my pay. Let's just say that.
And not tongue-tied doing it.
No.
That's all very impressive.
No, I practice in the mirror all the time, like Churchill or something like that.
Yeah, he was quite a guy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, two times back, it's been three times back, we were talking about hoaxes and narratives and all that. And then we kind of complained a little bit about some of the ways narratives are used and related to facts. And then the time after that, we talked about maybe we should offer a positive take on how to engage the culture. And we talked at length about the uniqueness of Jesus and his place in our understanding of the truth and so on. Mm-hmm. It occurred to me maybe it'd be good to talk about how it is that those truths, that is the truth that comes through Jesus into all the details of our lives, how those truths about and wisdom about life could be best communicated, and how do we make a society as good as it can be, and how does that societal information get transmitted? Is it best to, for example, elect the right people or write the laws for the society that the laws kind of could keep hem us in and keep us moral and like that? Or is there a better way? And I'm thinking there's a better way. I think there are some limits to the law. I'm really interested in the power of knowing history and the power of writing and crafting art, literature, music, film, video games, all those things as a kind of cultural output that actually does a better job of inspiring future generations, even this generation.
Right. I mean, we made the argument before in public and private and, you know, elsewhere. I'm not sure what the elsewhere is, but whatever. We've made the argument before that the transformation, the only way that really you change a society in any sort of deep or lasting way is on the cultural level, because that's the level that affects the hearts and the minds.
That's right. Maybe if we write the stories and we write the music and we write the films and like that, then we might have a much stronger influence on even the politics down the way. I always think of politics as a very small part of our lives.
Sure.
Because it really is an external kind of thing, where it's a hemming in of evil. It's keeping us from doing evil rather than making us do good. Mm-hmm. And I think the inspiration to do good comes from places other than the law.
Right. Now, usually when this type of discussion gets raised, not necessarily here, but like when I've heard this discussion get raised about, well, politics is downstream from culture, and it's, you know, the stories we tell, not the laws we write, that have the biggest effect. Usually when that discussion gets raised, it's usually to rail against our highly activist-minded, people today. I'd love to say current generation, but there's some older people. Like it cuts across generations. There's a swath of people out there who are heavy into activism and political action, and, you know, if you're not doing political action, then you're not really doing anything.
Right.
So somehow if we can get this idea that, well, it's really culture first and then politics, we have a way of fighting and winning.
Right.
So we're always trying to snap people out of a spell, you know, of another encounter narrative. And so it'd be interesting to see not just, well, we need to tell stories, but what stories? Like, what should they embody? What should they say that other guys aren't saying? And as we said in the previous podcast, Jesus has to be at the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
In some way, if we're going to have a good counter-narrative.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories that have influenced us a little. Maybe you've got some favorites. And I'm with you about the idea that the word story, we're using that word story to imply far larger things than simply novels or short stories. But, you know, every opportunity to create and speak about films, poetry, theater of music, even.
Yeah.
Do you have any? I mean, you're a literary guy, right? I'm a musician. You're a literary guy, literature guy. You could go first, maybe, and tell what you have read lately. Maybe something that has inspired you, or maybe something you read long ago that inspired you.
As a writer, whenever I've taught like creative writing, which has been very few, unfortunately, but when I did, I try to tell my students that you have to understand yourself in some way if you want to understand your own writing. If you're trying to find your... It's not just that you have your voice, it's you also have your story.
Uh-huh.
There was an author named Pam Durban, who I didn't care for her books, or her Buddhist philosophy, actually, quite frankly, but especially when she tried to apply it to my mother's suffering and pain. But anyways, that showed me why Buddhism really doesn't work. But she did say something that I never forgot, and she said that every writer has their assigned topic, is what she said. Hmm. And what she meant was that everyone who's a writer or is a creative person, I would say, has a story they're trying to tell over and over and over again.
Interesting.
In different ways. And I always found that interesting and oddly compelling, because I think there's something true to that. It's not that you have the same plotted story, but there's some kind of thing you're constantly trying to say over and over and over and over again.
Something that you're using that your various plots to get across.
Right. And this is something that I've tried to consider and like think about, like, well, is there something that I'm constantly focusing around? Mm. What are the stories I'm focusing around? And it's not good enough to just say, well, I like the fantastic. I mean, that's a part of it. And by fantastic, I mean like fantasy, sci-fi, anything that's outside the ordinary.
Sure.
One of the stories... So what you have to do is you have to look at the stories that inspired you or have stuck with you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the stories that stuck with me throughout my life was St. George and the Dragon.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you mean the Fairy Queen? No, I actually mean the children's book.
Okay.
That was based off of book one of the Fairy Queen, which is insane. When you think about making a children's book based off that thing. But they basically just took George leading Una, and they cut out basically all the parts where they got separated and stuff like that. It's just him going there and fighting the dragon.
Oh, okay.
Something about confronting this, somebody who is willing to step into an arena or step into a space, whereas there's this overwhelming odds and this overpowering force that in the book, you know, it's like an awesome dragon, but in reality, it'd be like horrifying. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like absolutely to face this monstrous thing, you mm-hmm. know. If we're going Lovecraftian, it's some kind of cosmic Eldritch horror type of thing. This thing that's bigger than you and more powerful than you, and you step into it to fight it. And, you know, he gets knocked down and he like has to like retreat a bunch of times because he's horribly wounded. And yet he still wins. Like he still triumphs, even though there's something about stepping into something where you have to, it requires sacrifice and struggle, but you win against the monster.
Uh-huh.
So any story that has to do with stepping into the lair of the monster has always been something that struck me. You know, there's no perfect example of it. Even there was a movie that came out in the 80s called Dragon Slayer. It was made by Disney, and it was the one movie that when it happened, Disney realized that they kind of need to like have separate things for when they do stuff for kids and when they do stuff not for kids, because Dragon Slayer was like a Disney movie and it was like really dark and like violent and just people were like, this isn't a Disney movie, and Disney was like, okay, we're going to make Touchstone, I think that's what they made. They made something like that, another studio to like, oh, this is where we do our grown-up stuff.
Uh-huh.
But Dragon Slayer was basically just, there's a dragon in his lair, and these people are trying to find a wizard who sends his page boy, who's going to be the guy who winds up killing the dragon. And it was utterly imperfect, especially its view of like the Dark Ages and Christianity's role in it. It was extremely ahistorical and idiotic.
Yeah.
But it did the dragon so right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It did it so in the lair so right. I mean, you go in there and it like is something out of a horror movie in some way. It's not fun and games or like I'm the Shining Knight. It's dark and and the dragon is like always hidden, and the people of the village do the usual archetypal thing, right? They have to sacrifice, you know, one of their daughters, you know, because like part of the story. And you get, oh yeah, that's part of the story. Okay, well, like the guy has to go into the lair of the dragon after this has happened. And he's too late. When he finds her, she's dead, and like the dragon's babies are like
eating her.
Like trying to eat her. It's not as gross as it sounds, but the idea that they're like, yeah, this is like horrifying. This is like a monster.
Yeah.
And the thought that there's a guy willing to go into that darkness and face that horrifying thing.
Yeah.
Something about that has always started. Anything that had to do with a confrontation with evil on its own turf.
Yeah.
What kind of person is willing to do that, and what does it take to be that person?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why other things later on inspired me. Other things, the stories that inspired when I grew up and was actually more cognizant of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, like the Fairy Queen, like the actual Fairy Queen. All of the stories. I've read like 4 out of the 6. I need to read the last 2. I need to get to that. Anyway, the Fairy Queen itself, the whole story, the first one, which is what that kid's book was based off of, basically shows you, well, what did it take to be that guy? Like, what did it take to be that person? And when you meet the main character, when you meet George, who I call Red Cross, because he's like the Red Cross Knight in the story, he's nothing like he is in the book. Because in the book, he's a really good guy, and of course I'm going to fight the dragon, and you know, it's really hard, but I beat him. In the book, he's this kid, says that he's never been in a fight before ever, and the armor he wears is borrowed from somebody else. Like, it has all this show of dings and dents in it, but he's actually never been in a fight before in his life. And his horse is like really fiery and like one is like ready to get into a fight. And I think by true Disney logic, that says something about the rider of the horse. And he's this young, fiery blockhead, basically, who thinks he's going to do something amazing. And Una, who's the princess who needs his help, it's interesting. The main conceit of the whole story is that the two of them need each other. You know, it's not that the princess needs the knight to kill the dragon. It's that they need each other to get this thing done. Because she can't fight the dragon without him. And she also, she's not a warrior. So without him, she's defenseless against all the dangers.
Right.
And yet without her, he's dead meat. Like, there's this whole opening sequence in the story where a storm drives them into the woods, these nearby woods. And the woods have this show of, like, being really pretty and fertile and have all these different trees and stuff. But the deep, and they have a great canopy that keeps out the rain. But the deeper you go into the woods, the darker it gets and the more bare everything becomes and the more lost you become and you can't find your way out. And so they wind up, they think they're going out, but they actually are going deeper in, and they wind up in the center of the woods and they find this. What do they find? They find a lair.
Of course.
And of course, what does the knight want to do? He's like, well,
time for me to go in.
And Una tells him,
Hang on a second. Yeah.
Like, be careful, be cautious. I know this place better than you do. These are like, this is Error's den. This is the den of the monster Error. And these are their woods, and we really shouldn't be here. This is too dangerous. But he's like, I would be ashamed to turn back now. And you get sort of this hint that he's trying to impress the girl in some way. But she's like, look, okay, look, you're obviously going to go on this course, but just be careful. So he goes in, and there's Error, this horrifying, gross, ugly monster attacks him and almost kills him. As a matter of fact, it has him all wrapped up in, like, its tail, and he's all stuck, and everything. He can't fight it. And it's Una who tells him how to beat it. Una tells him, you got to strangle her, and that'll get you loose. And it says that he was so angry from being embarrassed that he has enough strength to, like, grab hold of Error's throat and, like, choke her to, like, let, you know, Error was a mother, like a female character. He was able to choke the Error to get loose and then, like, cut off its head, and he wins. And in that moment, it's like, well, Una can't fight Error. She can't. But without Una, Red Cross would have died. So they need each other.
So, yeah, I see. She's got some wisdom that he might not have.
Because Una represents the truth. All right? And in Edmund Spencer's, all those Fairy Queen stories, the knights in them were supposed to embody some particular virtue. And Red Cross is supposed to embody holiness. But holiness, which is kind of a zeal for the moral character of God, if I could put it that way. You know, I want to be godly. I want to be Christ-like. That sort of zeal to have that be embodiment of that moral order is reckless without the truth guiding it, without the truth showing him what to do. And evil in that story tries to drive the two of them apart and actually succeeds in doing it. And the bulk of the story is not fighting a dragon, which always kind of surprises people. I thought there was going to be a dragon fight.
Yeah.
No, the bulk of the story is they get separated and they have to come back together, and it's Una that brings them back together somehow. The truth seeks him out. And is in a way rescues him, because she finds him locked in this dungeon of this giant, and she goes and gets King Arthur. She goes and gets Arthur, and Arthur fights the giant and kills the giant and saves the Red Cross. And Red Cross awakes chastened and, you know, knowing he needs to listen to Una, basically.
How about that?
So what it takes is holiness wedded to the truth, a moral order that's wedded to the truth, is what creates the best knight that can go into the lair. And it's interesting how there's a lot of zeal out there today, you know, a lot of zealousness to do something good. People think there's a lot of dragons out there, you know, systemic oppression and all that type of jazz. But if your zeal to slay the dragon is not wedded to the truth, almost literally wedded to the truth, it can only go wrong. You can only be Red Cross for a big bulk of the story. He abandons Una because the evil guys convince him she's being unfaithful, which was false. But he winds up abandoning her and leaving, and he gets in with a bunch of really evil people. But he thinks I'm being a knight and I'm doing the right thing. But he's surrounded by just people who are deceivers and deceptive, and he's all in the wrong place. It's all false and fake. He actually finds out the castle he was at is all a facade, and it's actually built on like the bodies of the dead and stuff like that. And so the idea that in order to be that type of person, it has to have a holy zeal, but one that's wedded to truth, is important. That like the real heroes don't just have a moral center. It's a moral center that actually connects to reality in some way. And that, I don't know, I think that's important. I say that's important. There's something about that. Your characters have to be not just a moral center, but a moral center that rings true, that's connected to the truth in some way.
Well, you're really hitting on what's powerful about allegorical literature. And it can be done really badly, but in the hands of a genius like Spencer or even John Bunyan, where you have a very obvious kind of allegorical relationship, deep truths can be expressed and explained. And I think that's underneath even, I mean, there are allegorical elements of even sort of modern film. So that tradition, I think, carries on, and it can be very powerful when it's subtle, when it's under the radar kind of thing.
Or it's really effectively embodied in the characters really well.
But it isn't just a bit of, what would you call it? Propaganda. You can create propagandistic art, sort of,
you can have message characters.
Right. And that the superficiality of that kind of takes away from the whatever truth it might be speaking about. But don't you think that, I mean, I don't want to just pick on Christian films, but there are times when I feel it's just so heavy-handed and so one-dimensional.
My brain was there, too.
You were, too.
As soon as you just start saying propagandistic, I was like, do we want to talk about Christian films?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I'm thinking about maybe better to give good examples rather than bad ones. How about that?
Sure.
Deep truths can be expressed in stories. I'm thinking about Flannery O'Connor, and probably the short story that most people know of hers the best is "A Good Man Is Hard to Find."
Yes,
and here's this evil fellow that they just call the Misfit, who eventually he and his buddies murder this entire family, and it's horrible. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading it the first time and thinking, what on earth am I looking at here? Mm-hmm. It just starts off kind of trivially and gets worse and worse and worse, and then it gets bad, and then it stops. It seems like, you know? But you got to look a little more carefully than that. O'Connor was actually giving us a picture of redemption there, but it wasn't a cheap redemption. It wasn't a superficial, one-dimensional kind of thing. And I think then I started reading all of her. It was like potato chips. I couldn't stop. I had to read all of her short stories. One summer, I remember many years ago, I read one or two of them and thought, this is astonishing. And then I started reading them all. And almost all of them have some kind of little glimpse, just a splinter of redemption that maybe is a blinding flash, but it's just a quick blinding flash. And then the story's over, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about that moment in the... Most of our readers have probably read that particular story, where this grandmother, who up until then had been just completely self-absorbed and trivial, kind of came out of herself and realized that that she didn't need to be so critical and judgmental and all those things. And here's this evil man sitting before her, and she finally says to him, "Well, you're just like me. You're just like one of my own children," or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he shoots her. And then he says later on, he says she would have been a good woman if she had had somebody around to shoot her every moment of her life. And I think that's one of the most profound things I think I've ever heard. You know, it used to be philosophers in the Middle Ages would keep a human skull on their desks, in part to remember what's really going to happen to them. Right. Your death comes to us all. And it kind of gives you a sober... not only a sober appreciation of life, but maybe a more impetus to make today count, you know, because you never know when that time is going to come. And it was sort of like that, it seemed to me, when he says this thing. And so where's the redemption in it? Was there a redemption of some sort for the old woman? Perhaps. I think the redemption is actually in the misfit, because what happens is his two buddies come out of the woods after they've shot the rest of the family. You heard about it from a distance. You heard the gunshots. And it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. It's so realistic. It's not, you know, you can have a kind of comic violence in some ways, and it's not as ripping. But this was just gritty, down-to-earth, day-to-day stuff, and these people were all shot to death by these hoodlums. And they came out of the woods, and they're wearing some of the clothes that the people that they just shot.
Yeah.
You know, he made them take her shirt off first and then shot him. Yeah. Take him. So now he's wearing the man's shirt, you know. And they're laughing and kicking around and all that, and they come up to the misfit, and they say, because he's the kind of their ringleader, and they say, "This is some fun, isn't it?" And he says, "Shut up. It ain't no good in it," or I forget exactly the quote, but it's not that much fun anymore, in other words.
Right.
Something happened to him when he shot this woman, and she reached out to him as though to love him, to show him some affection,
right.
And he killed her. But now it's not the joy that it was before, just to be that. And I think that's the little tiny change in him. We don't see him say, "I gave my life to Jesus," or something. None of that. But he just suddenly is confronted with something that he didn't know what to do with. Yeah. And he's changed because of it.
I think it's that confrontation with things you don't know what to do with that is more compelling.
Yeah.
It's very compelling. I mean, I sit here talking about the Fairy Queen and that whole spiel about Red Cross and Una being, you know, the truth and holiness, how to be wed together. That's my usual teachable moment, and I think there's something true to it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the main thing that keeps me around when I watch or why I keep reading those stories. It's honestly because of the imaginative, fantastical nature of the thing.
Uh-huh.
There's something about those stories where you go and there's a main quest. There's a main thing you got to do, but while you're going along it, there's all this bunch of stuff that just sort of happens.
Uh-huh.
You know, that, you know, you're trying to get to the stupid dragon, but like all these other things occur. You're Gaion, the Knight of Temperance, and you're trying to you're trying to go somewhere else, but then you run paths with somebody that completely redirects your course, and you're trying to get to the Bower of Bliss to destroy Acrasia, the evil sorceress. But along the way, there's all this stuff that happens, and your life gets intersected with all these things that call something out of you and require something else, and it's dangers and it's perils, and there's monsters, and there's, you know, randomly, I'm trying to get to Krasia's Bower, but first let me help this castle break the siege that it has, or something like that. And there's something in those stories that kind of weirdly, like, episodic, and yet there's still a central core, like you're going some direction, but there's all these little things that branch off of it while you're headed that way. You're on this journey that has a destination, but along the way, there's all these little side things that, you know, aren't necessarily against your journey, but they're just part of it.
Sure.
There's some, and anything can happen.
Right.
There's something about that that's compelling, because there's something about that that feels like real life.
Yeah.
In some way.
Yeah.
I suppose, especially from the Christian view of things, which is the true view of things, that there is an ultimate destiny to history, an ultimate destiny to your soul, and you're on that journey towards that destiny, and there's a bunch of stuff that happens on the way that branches off of it, but it's still connected to it in some way. It shapes and changes you in some way.
Well, that kind of storyline is perfect for an analogy to life. And I'm thinking about the Canterbury Tales. Mm-hmm. Here they are trying to get to Canterbury. They're on pilgrimage, right? But they're telling stories along the way. Right. And it's the same idea. It's like you've got a goal that you're headed toward, but you're along the way, you have all sorts of little cubby holes and tangential paths and things. And that's very much like life. So it's allegorical on a whole lot of levels, I guess.
Yeah.
Also, I always think, you know, you just mentioned he wants to go and destroy this what did you call her?
A sorceress.
Sorceress. Crazy. There you go, sorceress. And my first thought is, how come everybody always has to go and kill people? Kill sorceresses and stuff. But in a story like that, in the fairy tale world, that's what you do with sorceresses. That's what you do with dragons. That's what you do with the evil ogre, you know,
right.
Jack and the Beanstalk. You have to, the ogres are there to be killed. That's what right. they're for, see? And I think people misunderstand those stories if they try and make them too realistic. Well, maybe she's a misunderstood sorceress.
Right.
You know, no, she represents what is evil. And so it's really a model for our engaging with and standing against true evil in this world.
Right.
It's just that for us, for Christians, we recognize that we wrestle not with flesh and blood. We wrestle with principalities and powers. We wrestle with evil in the spiritual realm.
Right.
And it's a very real war. And there's no prisoners taken.
Right. If you view the thing in purely materialist terms, you know, well, Akrasia is merely a biologically female.
Right.
Right. Right. And that's it. And then it's like, well, why does she have to be the bad guy? Why does she have to be the bad guy?
Don't you hear that a lot?
Why is she, what if she's misunderstood? What if she's been forced into this by capitalist heteronormative patriarchy or something like that?
Exactly. Exactly.
And if you deny the spiritual, then that's all you're kind of left with is like, well, I don't want to, you know, like, why does it have to be a girl? Why can't it be, you know, all this other?
Yeah.
If you
yeah.
look at it in the spiritual way, I guess, I mean, technically speaking, Akrasia could have been a guy, a girl, who care. That's not the
Doesn't
point.
Matter.
The point is
yeah.
that she's the embodiment of pure will to power manipulation.
Right.
Right? She's a sorceress not because, you know, women are bad. She's a sorceress because of one who uses magic to enslave others, one who uses power to yeah. enslave others to do their will is bad. Okay, it's bad. And it has to be embodied somehow. I'm sure they could embody it any other way, but you have to see that part of it. And it's a world that looks like ours just with like the veil, the tapestry flipped around or something like that, and you see the spiritual truth shot through everything.
Mm-hmm.
That incident where you go off on a side eddy into something maybe isn't just some meaningless detour. Maybe it is part of your journey. Part of your journey home. You know, in some way, and it's another thing you have to do. It's another place that's a part of it. I don't know how to put it more specific than that, but there's something about stories that are these combinations of journeys that also have you going into layers
uh-huh.
that have always been just absolutely fascinating to me and compelling to me. And I think it's because, I don't think it's because, I know it's because it's reflecting the truth, that that's real life on multiple levels.
Yeah.
You know, you have an ultimate destiny, and the things that happen in your life are connected to it in some way and are either damning or redeeming you, depending on which way you go with things, especially the ultimate choice about surrender to Christ, right? And right. on a deeper level, you know, it's about Christ himself. I mean, Christ is the one who went into the ultimate lair, right? He went into death's lair and he fought the ultimate horror. You know, he fought death and he won. And one day he's going to come back to another lair, which is the lair of this world, that's also full of devils filled, as Martin Luther put it. And he's going to overcome that, you know. So there's multiple levels in which this kind of story that it is reflects the truth, reflects mm-hmm. reality in some way. And it's reality that is compelling. All right, if I could put it that way, reality always strikes us across the face, the really real things. You can almost tell things aren't true if their profundity just does, if they aren't real, if their profundity just kind of just falls flat or they become platitudinous in mm-hmm. some way.
What I was thinking as you were talking about this and mm-hmm. what I was thinking, what love is and how Jesus teaches what love is and so on. And there's a scene in C.S. Lewis's sort of adult fairy tale called That Hideous Strength. You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's a hard scene to set up exactly right, but just that the sort of gods of the various planets are descending on this house, and the characteristics of Mars as a sort of angel almost,
yeah,
or and Venus and Mercury and Saturn and eventually Jupiter all descend on this house, and they bring with them an effect on the people right. there.
Cosmic influences.
Yeah. And I was just thinking about the one where Venus is, where he describes Venus descending on this house. And I thought I'd read it to you. Do
yeah,
you mind
yeah.
if I just, oh, let's just,
please,
let's just love, get a little goodness. Bit of Lewis's genius. There he has two scenes. He has these, the leader, what they call the director, Ransom, and he's in his office upstairs, and he's going to have direct contact with these right. these people when
he's
they come, these angels when they come.
Full frontal assault, basically.
Yeah. He and Merlin, it's a long story if you haven't read the book. But downstairs, the other people in the house are huddled together in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a description of what happens to them first, and then you have a description of what happens up in the main
right.
room.
So it's almost like in the kitchen, you get sort of a worked out in a humane
on a human level,
human
yeah.
level, and then when you get upstairs, it's more like just a pure abstract's not the right word, but they're getting it unfiltered.
That's
almost.
Right. That's right.
Except
That's
through
right.
their bodies is what they're. Basically.
So imagine that Lewis is trying to describe the character of love, because this is Venus. We don't know that it's Venus until later on, so I'm sorry I'm spoiling that revelation. But what he this is the way he's describing love, okay? So he says, down in the kitchen, drowsiness stole over them after the orgy of speaking had come to an end when Mercury
yeah,
had just arrived.
Thing.
Jane, our main character, having nearly fallen asleep, was startled by her book falling from her hand and looked about her. How warm it was, how comfortable and familiar. She had always liked wood fires, but tonight the smell of the logs seemed more than ordinarily sweet. She began to think it was sweeter than it could possibly be, than a smell of burning cedar or of incense pervaded the room. It thickened. Fragrant names hovered in her mind. Nard and cassia's balmy smells and all Arabia breathing from a box. Even something more subtly sweet, perhaps maddening. Why not forbidden? But she knew it was commanded. She was too drowsy to think deeply how this could be. The Dimbles, the older couple, were talking together, but in so low a voice that others could not hear. Their faces appeared to her transfigured. She could no longer see that they were old, only mature, like ripe fields in August, serene and golden with the tranquility of fulfilled desire. On her other side, Arthur said something in Camilla's ear, the younger couple. There too, but as the warmth and sweetness of that rich air now fully mastered her brain, she could hardly bear to look on them, not through envy, that thought was far away, but because a sort of brightness flowed from them that dazzled her, as if the god and goddess in them burned through their bodies and through their clothes and shone before her in a young, double-natured nakedness of rose-red spirit that overcame her. And all about them danced, as she half saw, not the gross and ridiculous dwarves which she had seen that afternoon, that's a reference to something you don't know about, but grave and ardent spirits, bright winged, their boyish shapes smooth and slender like ivory rods, excuse me. In the blue room upstairs, also, Ransom and Merlin felt about this time that the temperature had risen. The windows, they did not see how or when, had swung open. At their opening, the temperature did not drop, for it was from without that the warmth came. Through the bare branches across the ground, which was once more stiffening with frost, a summer breeze was blowing into the room. But the breeze of such a summer as England never has. Laden with heavy barges that glide nearly gunwale under, laden so heavily that you would have thought it could not move, laden with ponderous fragrance of night-scented flowers, sticky gums, groves that drop odors, and with cool savor of midnight fruit, it stirred the curtains. It lifted a letter that lay on the table. It lifted the hair, which had a moment before been plastered on Merlin's forehead. The room was rocking. They were afloat. A soft tingling and shivering as of foam and breaking bubbles ran over their flesh. Tears ran down Ransom's cheeks. He alone knew from what seas and from what islands that breeze blew. It's a reference to the second book because he had been to Venus.
Right, Paralonga.
And so he knows where these. Mm. And he misses it. Merlin did not know, but in him also the inconsolable wound with which man is born, waked and ached at this touching. Low syllables of prehistoric Celtic self-pity murmured from his lips. These yearnings and fondlings were, however, only the forerunners of the goddess, as the whole of her virtue seized, focused, and held that spot of the rolling earth in her long beam, something harder, shriller, more perilously ecstatic, came out of the center of all the softness. Both the humans trembled, Merlin because he did not know what was coming, Ransom because he knew. And now it came. It was fiery, sharp, bright, and ruthless, ready to kill, ready to die, outspeeding light. It was charity, mm-hmm. with a capital C. It was charity, not as mortals imagine it, not even as it has been humanized for them since the incarnation of the Word, but the translunary virtue fallen upon them, direct from the third heaven, unmitigated. They were blinded, scorched, deafened. They thought it would burn their bones. They could not bear that it should continue. They could not bear that it should cease. So Paralandra, triumphant among planets, whom men call Venus, came and was with them in the room. Well, that's a fairy tale that tells the truth, mm-hmm. and it tells a truth that Lewis saw as a Christian. He understood, but as a human being, he understood. And I just think we have such tepid versions of love. We think love is a momentary physical reaction or a chemical reaction or a soft, fuzzy feeling that we feel. But he starts with some of that stuff, and he brings you right into the very center of what is blazing charity. Charity, love, that is, love, right? Not charity. We think of charity as giving money to the poor. But that's just an act of charity. That's mm-hmm. not charity. Right. Charity is this all-encompassing drive, burning white hot, to care for, to love others,
it's the powerful pictures that we need, you know, the strength of it.
But that's what literature can do for us. That you were talking about Red Cross, you were talking about the lack of it in a fireproof movie.
It's
what literature can do for us. Get that picture across. I don't even know that I can put what he put into words. You know?
Because it feels like it would be less than what
definitely
he said.
Definitely less.
I mean,
but I'm not sure I even understand fully. I'm just moved by it.
We live in a Christian universe.
Yes.
All right? Like, Christ is the truth, and he is the logos that holds all things together and grounds all reality and existence, physical and non-physical, and all concepts and ideas and terms within any discourse are only true insofar as they reflect him.
Yeah.
And any action is a true and right action only insofar as it reflects him. And so it's him shining through. And what's genius about the sequence is Lewis is taking the idea that is not foreign to Christian thought. There are like church fathers have this idea that somehow God's attributes, you know, every virtue is sort of the, how to put it, because God is not divided, but it's like every virtue that we consider separately is an aspect of God.
Yes.
Although God is all virtue together as one God.
But somehow
God,
an aspect of him or a facet of him is reflected in a certain thing.
And somehow, I mean, you know, like St. Maximus the Confessor talked about how the different virtues we see are different aspects of God's godness that are outflowing and outpouring in different directions. And what Lewis is doing is he's using the angelic creatures, the angelic beings, who are the lords of different planets. Each of them embodies a particular thing that's a virtue of God. He used the word virtue, which he's using in the old term, not in just the sense of goodness, but in the sense of power, like certain power influence flowing out of it, the different virtues of God. And Jesus is God incarnate.
Right.
So he's the ultimate embodiment of the of God. In some way. So we're looking for him in some way. You know, we're looking, that's what we're trying to look for.
And that's right.
We know when we see it and we know when we don't see it. Even if we don't know about Christ, the thing that compels us or is so powerful is somehow reflecting him. So like in the first Captain America movie, when he's like first becoming Captain America, he's on the military base, and he's still a little scrawny dude. He hasn't gone through the thing yet. And Tommy Lee Jones' character is the general who's, like, trying to run this operation, and he's just unimpressed. He's like, he tells the scientist dude who picked Rogers that, you know, when you wanted a 90-pound asthmatic on my military base, I was like, okay, fine. Maybe, you know, you can have him as a pet or something like that. But you want him to be the guy who's going to be the super soldier that leads her? No way. Okay, look at him. He's scrawny and he's little. And the scientist dude keeps insisting that it's not in Roger's body that it matters. It's his character that matters.
Yes.
And Tommy Lee Jones' character is like, what about this dude? And some guy who's big, kind of a bruiser, is like, he's big, he's strong, he's fast, he's a soldier. And the scientist is like, he's a bully. And Tommy Lee Jones' character is like, wars aren't won by niceness. They're won by guts, he says. Mm-hmm. And then he reaches into a box of dummy grenades, like training grenades. He just grabs it, pulls the pin, flips it out, and he throws it in the midst of all of his troops, Rogers and this big guy included. And he's like, grenade! Everybody scatters. Like, every last person scatters away except Rogers. Rogers dives on the grenade. And he's like telling everybody else to get back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a crazy acting job by Chris Evans because he's like all tensed up, knowing a grenade's about to go off and I'm about to take the brunt of it. But he just falls on it without even thinking.
Yeah.
And it shows that he actually, that's what real guts looks like. It's not that you're big and bruisery. It's that you're willing to fall on the grenade for the other guy. There's, in a real life context, there was a story I heard about how there was some military base over in, an American military base over in somewhere in the Middle East. This was years ago. Typical horrible thing had happened. Some insurgency had driven a truck, like loaded with explosives, right up to the gate and like slammed into it and blown up. And these two Marines had died in the process of doing it. And they were able to find security footage. They somehow were able to recover security footage of the gate. And at the gate, these two Marines were at the gate. And it was them and a bunch of, like, local security guys. Like, I can't remember what country it was. It was in Iraq. It was, like, Iraqi security guys that they had trained.
Right.
And you see the truck come barreling down towards them. And everybody scatters. Everybody scatters away from the gate except the two Marines.
Oh, wow.
They stand there with their guns up and just stand there shooting. And wow. They don't move, even as the truck, like, they don't move. And that's why they died, because they didn't run for cover. And somebody asked, like, some general or something like that, you know, were the other guys, the not Marine guys, were they cowards? Mm. And he was like, absolutely not. So they did exactly what any ordinary person would and should have done.
Right.
Right? It's like there's, right. They did nothing wrong. It's what anybody would have done. It's just those two guys who stood their ground did something extraordinary.
Exactly.
And it's like that image of true, like, show them like an image of true courage.
Yes.
That's willing to make the sacrifice play and do it well. Do it in a way that's worthy of courage. Do it in a way that's worthy of courage, because courage has a name, and his name is Christ.
Amen.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The definition that Jesus gives us of love is that there's no greater love than to lay down your life for your friends. And whether our society still understands where that idea came from, we still admire and take our hats off to people who are willing to sacrifice themselves for the benefit of those around them. We call them heroes.
Right.
That they are. They're extraordinary. But it's because they are Christ-like that they are extraordinary. Right. That's what's different. I remember there's a story, a true story, of a plane that crashed into the one of the bridges over the Potomac there, just near a national airport, one winter. This is 40 years ago now. It crashed into this bridge. It was the wings were iced up or something, and it couldn't actually get enough altitude, and it rammed into this bridge. And, of course, then it spilled people out into the Potomac River. Many of them died immediately, but some of them were in the icy water, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had a rescue helicopter that had come out to try and pick them up, you know, and get them out of that water. The water was, you know, 31 degrees or something, 32 degrees right there. Miserable. You can only live in it for a few minutes.
Right.
And there was a jogger running down the path along the Potomac. There were these jogging paths right on the river. And this jogger saw what was happening, that the people were so cold in the water that they couldn't even hang on to the rope ladder, you know, that was being extended to them to help them out of the water. And he dove into the river and swam out to them and helped them. And he saved five or six different people and got them out of the water. And when they went back to look for the jogger, they couldn't find him. He had drowned. And I think, you know, we use that word hero a lot of times in the wrong way. We say, you know, a basketball player is my hero. You know, right. He's a great basketball player.
Or someone who did something spectacular.
Exactly, right, right. But that's heroic, you know. That guy didn't need to dive in the water. Mm-hmm. He didn't need to do that, but he did it anyway. Yeah. And there are people who owe their lives to him now.
Yeah.
And that's stunning.
It's interesting. Even our use of the word hero has been transformed by Christ, because we solely associate it with the good, and typically someone who sacrifices for all.
Yeah.
The older sort of pre-Christian version of a hero, I don't know if they had that word, but the idea of hero,
yeah, mythological kind of use,
was just somebody who did a great, legendary,
great
amazing
deeds.
Thing.
Sure, Hercules.
Yeah, they may have been horrible people. You know,
right.
Achilles is technically a hero.
Exactly.
Even though he just brutalized Hector so bad that even the gods, you know, those capricious, amoral gods, even they were horrified.
Right.
By it, right. An example, this will be my last example, sort of like both ways of doing this, seeing those two ways, like what happens when sacrifice is the main thing and when it's not, is why the movie Pitch Black that had Riddick in it was so popular, and why the Chronicles of Riddick movie that had him in it was fun, but it just kind of...
Yeah. Lightweight.
It didn't have the same punch. It didn't go anywhere. I mean, they had like a third movie that was like called Riddick or something like that, whatever. But why? Well, Riddick is this kind of amoral character. I mean, technically he's immoral, but he like has no moral center, mm-hmm. right? And he's sort of this early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, gritty, amoral, you know, Shades of Grey kind of, you know, character, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That was very popular for a while. In the first movie, he's not the main character, right? The main character, or he's not the only main character. There's another main character, which was the ship captain. Mm-hmm. Who in the opening of the movie, she's flying this ship that has all these people like in hyperstasis, and it, something happens where they're about to crash on this planet, and she is about to eject everybody into space to like lighten the load. And her own she was like lieutenant. The captain of the ship was telling her, "Don't you do it." Mm-hmm. And she's like, has her hand on the switch, and finally she's like, "I'm not dying for them," and she's about to flip the switch to eject everybody into space to save herself.
Wow.
But then, like, something happens where they're about to really crash and she can't do it. And so she's not able to do it. Well, Riddick and a couple other and someone else knows that that's what happened, that she was actually about to kill everybody to save herself. And so Riddick, of course, Mr. Amoral, is like, well, of course, you know, that's exactly what you would do. She goes to the movie and she's the only one who's kind of a leader. So she has to sort of lead these people through this dangerous situation with the monsters and trying to get out of there, and she has to take care of them. And by the end of the movie, there's this moment where Riddick abandons them. Mm-hmm. He like puts them in a nook of a rocks of a cliff somewhere and says, "Quick, hide here," and they get in there, and then he pushes a rock in front of the door and locks them in so he can go to the escape shuttle himself.
Oh.
Because, you know, he's just pure animal. He's just all survival instinct, and that's
gotcha.
It.
Yeah.
Well, the captain lady manages to get out of there and says, "I'm going to go after him." And she chases after him and chases him down. And he gets her. She tries to stop him, and he like is bigger and stronger than she is. But he gets her on the ground, and he's like, "Why are you doing this?" Because he knows that she originally tried to pull him away.
And
she's like, "Why are you doing this? Would you die for them?"
Yeah.
And she says, "Yes, I would die for them."
Yeah.
Like she's changed.
She's changed.
And Riddick is like, "That's very interesting." And then he goes back and gets the people out. And for some reason, it changes him.
Okay.
So in that movie, you have someone who changes and gets redeemed in her redemption. And she does die in the end. All right. Actually trying to help him, like trying to save him and get him to the ship. She winds up dying in it. Spoilers. Mm-hmm. And so there's real sacrifice and redemption.
And then he actually takes care of the rest of them.
Right, takes care of the rest of them.
Gets them and flies them off the planet.
Yeah. Now, in the second movie, Chronicles of Riddick, he is the main character because he's in the title of it. But he's his usual amoral whatever, and he kind of cares about the girl that he got off the planet. But, you know, it doesn't have the same punch, even though he's like, he still is trying to be like, "I'm Riddick, I'm all amoral," and stuff like that, and still care about this girl at the same time. Something about it is not as compelling mm-hmm. as watching this other character truly transform and inspire him. Mm-hmm. And there's something about this, like something about that had the greater gravitas than when it was just him on his own. He's not good enough. A purely amoral character, that's their essence. Mm-hmm. You can't. It's like it's harder to make them compelling as the sacrificial character in some way.
We probably ought to wrap it up here. How about recommendations?
Okay.
I'm thinking I'd like to recommend, for those who've never read it, this That Hideous Strength. Mm. I'm just reading through that with one of our students now, and I've read it many years ago, but I'm so impressed with it again. It's, you know, it's not perfect writing. It's not truly great writing like some of the things we've referenced earlier, but you heard the little bit of it. Lewis has something very important to talk about. Well, several things very important to talk about. And if you know his nonfiction books, you spot them all. Yeah. You know, as you go through, you see him talking about that this is a scene that is to exemplify the idea that he puts forth in this essay or that essay or whatever, right. And Abolition of Man or Problem of Pain, or I mean, he talks at length about vivisection and the problem of pain, and here it is in this book, and the question about he's got a terrific little essay called the inner ring, thank you, the inner ring, where it's all about the pressures of being wanting to be on the inside and what compromises you might make in order to be on the inside. And this story talks about a character that goes through that same thing. But then it also talks an awful lot about the depth of maleness and femaleness. And I think in a day like ours, when those sorts of things are being, those two things in particular are being blurred and lost and lost their distinguishing characteristics, it's really good to read something like this, because he has a sense for maleness and femaleness that's profound. Mm-hmm. So I'd recommend that, Hideous Strength. Now, it's the third in a trilogy of books, and you could start with the first one, Out of the Silent Planet, and the second one, Paralandra, but it stands alone. Each of them stand alone, I think, but you can read them in order if you'd prefer, and that may be the best way. Mm. Have you got something you'd like to recommend?
I think what I'm going to recommend is going to be rare for me, because I have found as I go through my scholarly life that I'm not much for secondary literature. You know, I don't care to read a bunch of essays about Spencer. I'd rather read Spencer.
Sure.
Or I would rather read Chesterton than read some sort of book about him.
Right.
Not that there hasn't been some good ones, but still, I'm just like, I get unimpressed. You know, it just is a mountain of stuff that probably won't last. Mm-hmm. Unless it's like classic or older criticism that stood the test of time in some
ways. Sure.
That's usually good. So I'm going to be out of character for me and actually recommend a piece of secondary literature. Not instead of recommending The Faerie Queen, which I think, you know, should be obvious, you should be reading that. There is a work of criticism on The Faerie Queen, also by C.S. Lewis, who was a, what did he call himself, medieval Renaissance scholar,
yes,
basically.
He
was in that sort of vein of things where the overlap of the medieval and the Renaissance worlds. And Spencer was something that was a big thing for him.
Right.
And he wrote a work of Spencerian criticism called Spencer's Images of Life. Mm. And it is a small little book. It's not a big, thick book like Allegory of Love or something like that. It's a small little book, and it's very readable. And he has chapters in there about Spencer's view of evil and Spencer's view of the good, mm-hmm. and how he embodies that in characters and what he's trying to say, and those are absolutely fantastic. But the whole work itself, Spencer's Images of Life, is great. And it's not that long either. It's very, very, for a work of criticism, it's a very small little book.
Not like Experiment in Criticism.
No, or like I said, like Allegory of Love.
Or
it's nothing like that
love.
Big. Yeah. So that's what I recommend is C.S. Lewis's, two C.S. Lewis books here.
Hey,
that Hideous Strength, and then Spencer's Images of Life.
We didn't even plan that.
No, we didn't. That's all for today. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.
So long.